Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Thalia Zapatos, Director of Public Engagement with the group Freedom to Marry, who examines the historic nature and possible outcomes of the same-sex marriage cases now before the U.S. Supreme Court. Ellen Brown of the Public Banking Institute, who explains why she's concerned that the European Union's confiscation of depositor funds in Cyprus could be a template for future similar confiscations in U.S. and U.K. banks. And Reverend Samuel Saylor, who in a speech made at a recent Hartford, Connecticut rally against urban street violence, called for solidarity between urban and suburban communities in the campaign for stricter gun control laws. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry could move quickly to ease tensions with Cuba by taking the Caribbean nation off Washington's list of state sponsors of terrorism. Communist Cuba has been on the list since 1982. The U.S. State Department's annual list on terrorism is scheduled to be released on April 30th, but there is little formal indication Kerry, whom as a U.S. senator favored better relations with Cuba, will advise the White House to take Cuba off the list. Tensions between the U.S. and Cuba have eased due to greater bilateral cooperation on customs and homeland security issues. During his first term, President Obama relaxed Bush-era restrictions on expatriate Cubans visiting the island while permitting larger cash transfers from the U.S. to family members in Cuba. The Boston Globe reported that high-level diplomats are pushing to have Cuba taken off the terrorist list. However, better relations are hampered by Cuba's continued imprisonment of USAID contractor Alan Gross, who was charged with bringing advanced communications equipment to Jewish groups and dissidents inside Cuba. Cuban officials have discussed a humanitarian prisoner exchange that involves trading Gross's freedom for members of the Cuba Five. Thus far, the U.S. State Department has rejected such a deal. The Cuba Five is a group of intelligence agents convicted of spying on anti-Castro groups in the Cuban-American community in Florida. The recent release of information on the guns, ammunition, and other weapons and information found by Connecticut State Police at Newtown mass shooter Adam Lanza's home left an image of an angry young man obsessed with guns, extreme violence, and video games. But the evidence does not provide a clear motive for the horrifying killing spree of 20 first graders and 6 educators at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. Among people with severe mental illness, mass murders are extremely rare. Many troubled young men involved in violent incidents have a dual diagnosis of severe mental illness and substance abuse, but only receive sporadic treatment for either illness. These young men are currently not eligible for Medicaid, and youths with this dual diagnosis are 4 times more likely to commit violent acts than mentally ill persons who are not dealing with substance abuse problems. The result is that many young men with mental illness are housed in jails. In Chicago, for example, the city's largest jail has 22% of its inmates diagnosed with some form of mental illness. This situation will likely change for the better in 2014 when the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, kicks in and millions who are currently uninsured can gain access to mental health care through the Medicaid program. Scouts from U.S. Major League Baseball teams searched the Dominican Republic for young, talented players they can train and eventually bring back to play in the big leagues. Shortstop Yuri Guillen first talked with a scout at age 15. A year later, he signed a deal with the Washington Nationals that included a $30,000 bonus. The young player practiced at the Nationals' Boca Chica Baseball Academy in the Dominican Republic. The Nationals were set to send the young shortstop to Florida to play in the rookie league, but then he suffered severe health problems. Without health insurance, the player was rejected by a top-tier private hospital. A local clinic later diagnosed him with bacterial meningitis, and he soon died. The death of the young ball player is an extreme example of how many Dominican baseball prospects are abused in a country with a 40% poverty rate. According to Mother Jones magazine, the baseball training camps run by major league clubs are often substandard operations. In the mid-1990s, an academy run by the St. Louis Cardinals slept 8 players to a room, and the playing field was riddled with rocks. A facility run by the Chicago Cubs had 1 bathroom without running water for 18 ball players. In 2009, Major League Baseball sent Sandy Alderson, now the general manager of the New York Mets, to investigate. His report called for shaking up operations of the baseball academies, yet most clubs responded by slashing prospect bonuses and failing to invest in improving their training facilities. Longtime Dominican agent Aston Jacobo observed, "It's no secret to anybody that we have been taken advantage of for 50 years." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In two landmark cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, the future of same-sex marriage hangs in the balance. Although the high court rulings in these cases will determine the shape of marriage law in the U.S. in the short term, it seems inevitable that with a dramatic shift in Americans' attitudes moving toward approval of gay marriage, the nation will eventually realize full marriage equality. The first of two cases being considered involved a challenge to California's Proposition 8 ban on gay marriage that was approved by voters in 2008, overturning a ruling legalizing same-sex marriage handed down earlier by California's Supreme Court. The second case heard by the justices contests the constitutionality of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, that defines marriage as between a man and a woman, banning federal recognition of same-sex marriage and effectively denying tax, Social Security, and other ordinary benefits to gay couples. Many legal observers who assessed the justices' interaction with and questions to attorneys in the two cases predicted the court's rulings, expected this June, would likely usher in incremental change rather than a broad decision mandating the legalization of marriage equality in all 50 states. Your reporter spoke with Thalia Zapatos, director of public engagement with the group Freedom to Marry, who examines the historic nature and possible outcomes of the same-sex marriage cases now before the Supreme Court.
You know, both cases before the court last week were fundamentally about whether gay and lesbian Americans should have the same freedoms and protections as everyone else in our country. You know, I think all couples find someone they want to marry and share their hopes and dreams with, and they marry to be there for one another and protect each other, you know, in good times and in bad. And so, you know, what's at stake in these two cases are a number of different pieces. One is very specifically in terms of the DOMA case, is literally whether same-sex couples will be penalized at the federal level, both economically and in a sort of moral sense, for being legally married in their own state. In the California case, similarly, you know, that 18,000 couples were able to get married when marriage was legal there, and then a big door was shut. And so we have now additional couples in California who are seeking the opportunity to marry and care for the person they love. And as Justice Kennedy pointed out in his comments, also 30,000 children being raised by same-sex couples in California who come home from school and ask their parents why they can't be married too, or why they can't be a real family.
In terms of the various scenarios that we can guess at of what the Supreme Court will decide here, what's the best case scenario for your organization and the worst case scenario? And maybe we can also just briefly discuss some of the state by state strategies that I know you've all been thinking about for quite some time.
Yeah, certainly. Well, the best case scenario for us would be first overturning DOMA so that those couples that are legally married, you know, currently in nine states plus the District of Columbia, will be eligible for the same level of federal protections and responsibilities as well, that they will file their federal taxes jointly and not be forced to file singly, for example. So that would be a tremendous benefit to those families as well as military families. I mean, there's a lot of gray area now and, you know, very difficult situations that active duty military who are married have where, you know, their spouse or children are not allowed to live in married family housing, etc. So overturning DOMA would clarify a lot of that and really open the doors to those couples who are legally married in that list of states. the best scenario in the Perry case, certainly the broadest possible scenario, would be a 50-state decision that would say that, you know, there's no reason to discriminate against same-sex couples in any state, and that the Supreme Court finds that, you know, equal protection under the law includes equal rights to marriage. So that would be the broadest. The narrowest would be potentially rejecting the Perry case on standing, or, you know, agreeing with the Ninth Circuit Court, which would legalize marriage once again in California. And then there's an in-between scenario that the Department of Justice laid out in their brief and made the case for, which was that states that offer all of the same legal protections, either calling it civil union or domestic partnership, that's another 8 or 9 states right now, that those states should just simply be reviewed and potentially be considered states where marriage would also be quickly become legal for same-sex couples. That's a little less certain, and the path to that, you know, depending on how the decision is written, would be a little less clear. But in any event, it seems clear to us that we've got work to do, you know, going back to the states, and whether it's just public education work or actually running additional campaigns and persuading state by state to support marriage for same-sex couples, you know, we feel we've got some work set out for us in the next couple of years.
I did want to ask you about the importance of other battles here in terms of equality. I've heard from some, not a lot, but there are some critics out there who say instead of marriage being the priority issue for the LGBT community, it really should be the issue of employment discrimination. How do you see the relative importance of marriage equality and discrimination at the workplace, which has not been addressed to many people's satisfaction?
That's a great question, Scott. Sometimes I've, you know, been in conversations with voters who say, you know, why is it the gay community keeps bringing this up? But part of it is that anti-gay forces keep bringing it up. And I think they've grabbed on marriage as a sort of social issue that they can generate a lot more anxiety around, and that has, in some ways, propelled marriage forward. I think the good news for the whole movement is once we get people thinking about who gay and lesbian people are, you know, why same-sex couples are more similar than different from themselves, that as we kind of break down these barriers, that flows into employment non-discrimination and issues around gender identity as well. So it's a kind of, you know, closing the gap and helping people see that there are fewer differences and more similarities. And I think that will spill over very, very quickly to employment non-discrimination as well. I mean, once we have same-sex couples getting married in more states, our biggest problem on employment sometimes is that people assume that those protections are already in place. They're often very shocked if they live in a state that has no employment non-discrimination protection and are very, very willing and supportive to see that get passed.
That was Thalia Zapatos, Director of Public Engagement with the group Freedom to Marry. Learn more about the ongoing campaign of the marriage equality movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the nations of the European Union continue to pursue austerity policies to address the continent's ongoing economic crisis, the news is not good. The EU's unemployment rate rose in January to 26.2 million people, or 10.8% of the working age population. Youth unemployment increased to a record level of 23.6%, with nearly 60% jobless in both Greece and Spain. In another grim indicator, the gross domestic product across the EU contracted by 0.5%, the worst decline since 2009. Now an EU-engineered bailout of the Cyprus banking system has created a new crisis of confidence among people across Europe. Cyprus, with a banking industry over 5 times larger than the nation's annual GDP, attracted billions of euros from overseas due to its low tax rates, especially from Russia's oligarchs and wealthy class. Now, as part of a $13 billion bailout deal made with the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and EU, collectively known as the Troika, the nation's second-largest bank will be closed, and severe limits have been placed on withdrawals from all Cypriot banks.
But the bailout condition that has caused the most public anger and unease across the EU is the decision to tax a reported 30-40% of funds from depositor accounts of more than 100,000 euros in Cypriot banks, leading to fears of similar confiscations in other Eurozone nations. Your reporter spoke with Ellen Brown, chairperson and president of the Public Banking Institute and author of the book Web of Debt. Here, Brown explains why she believes that the European Union's confiscation of depositor funds in Cyprus could serve as a template for future confiscation of funds deposited in U.S. and British banks.
Well, they have two bankrupt banks, which interestingly were declared quite solvent or not, or they passed a stress test like 2 weeks before they were declared hopelessly bankrupt. And in order to, they needed a loan from the Troika, the IMF, ECB, EC. And in order to get it, they were told that they had to do a tax on the depositors in those banks, including the insured depositors. Well, the people took to the streets and protested and said no way were they going to approve taking the deposits of the bank to bail out the bank. And so that the solution they came to was that the insured depositors didn't have to pay, the ones with under 100,000 euros in the bank. But the ones over that had to pay a very sizable haircut, as it's called, 40%. And now they're talking it could go as high as 80%. I mean, they're virtually going to confiscate this money. Much of it is Russian oligarchs and tax haven people and so forth, people you're not too sympathetic with. But they're also, their businesses are there. European businesses have their money there. And what if you have a business? Right now, even the insured depositors, nobody can get more than 300 euros out per day. What if you have to run a business and you have to pay your workers out of your bank account? So it's really quite alarming, and it was sort of billed at first as a one-off, well, this is an emergency, and that was just a special case. But as you look around the world, it really isn't. It's called bail-in, where you go after the creditors of the bank itself. Basically, what we've come to is that governments have said, we're not going to bail out the big banks anymore. Right, we have the Dodd-Frank bill, which says the big, too-big-to-fail banks can continue to gamble in derivatives, but that the taxpayers are not going to bail them out in the event of a major derivatives fiasco. And so recent hearings have revealed that they're actually commingling funds, and they're allowed to do it, I guess. So they've got the derivatives are in the same branch as the deposits. Well, for example, J.P. Morgan has over $1 trillion in deposits, and they have $79 trillion in derivatives, which is more than the gross domestic product of the whole world, just in derivatives. And that, I mean, that's just J.P. Morgan. So if they had a big derivatives crisis, the government is not going to help. Even if they wanted to, FDIC on the insurance only has $25 billion in the fund, and there's something like $9 trillion in deposits in the whole country. So they clearly don't have enough in the fund for a big crisis. So what all these plans are for, they seem to have emanated from the G20 Financial Stability Board, which the 20 nations signed on to in 2009 as a sort of global regulator of our banks. They are the ones that told all these countries that they have to set up some sort of bail-in provisions, which are provisions where you go after your own creditors. Well, what people don't realize is that we are creditors of the bank. As soon as you put your money in the bank, it becomes the money of the bank, and we become creditors. All we have is an IOU. We used to be insured creditors, but now we can see from what's happening in Cyprus that we can't count on that anymore.
Ellen, most people who deposit money in banks here in the United States are fairly assured for many years that the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, was to insure that money. If the bank went belly up, that they would get their money out. What's the limit, $250,000 or less?
Right.
So What are the loopholes that would allow the government, the bank, or whoever to confiscate your money if you're within the confines of the FDIC insurance agreement?
Well, it's just that they don't have enough money in the fund. And what would happen if there was a big derivatives bust that was bigger than that? They've required the big banks to do these, they're called living wills, where they set out what they would do, how they would save themselves in the event of a big crisis, because under Dodd-Frank, they've been told, the government, don't count on the government. We're not going to fix your derivatives losses for you. So then they've come up with these plans, and I saw the J.P. Morgan one, and it says there's this FDIC Bank of England directive that says they will take the money of the unsecured creditors and turn it into stock. So basically it's a debt for equity swap. They have a debt to us, as we're considered unsecured creditors. And what they'll give us instead is bank stock. But it's bank stock in what could well be a bankrupt bank if you look at Lehman Brothers or whatever. So they've totally changed the rules of the game, which means you can't tell what could happen. In the FDIC Bank of England directive, it doesn't say anything about insured deposits being excluded. It doesn't even mention them. So it seems to me intentionally vague. I mean, the whole thing is vague. It's hard to read. But it seems to me that they're setting us up for, you know, this is kind of a warning, like, be prepared, this could happen here because we don't know what's coming down. And if there's another big black swan event, they could hit the depositors.
That was Ellen Brown, an attorney and president of the Public Banking Institute. She's the author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Find links to Brown's recent articles, including the confiscation scheme planned for U.S. and U.K. depositors, on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just a few days before the Connecticut General Assembly was about to cast votes on a package of new strict gun safety laws, hundreds of people turned out March 30th for the 5th annual march and rally against urban street violence in Hartford. The demonstration was organized by the group Mothers United Against Violence and supported by other groups, including Connecticut Against Gun Violence and Newtown Action Alliance, which was founded soon after the December 14th Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre, where a lone gunman killed 20 first graders and 6 educators. Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy and U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, who were at the rally, called for tougher gun safety laws at both the state and federal level as mothers read the names of 19 people recently killed in Connecticut urban violence. Marchers carried 358 white crosses, representing the number of people who have died in gun-related violence in Hartford since 2000. The Reverend Samuel Saylor of Hartford, who also spoke at the rally, recounted how he'd counseled many parents over the years who lost their children to street violence, but didn't really grasp the enormity of the loss until his own 20-year-old son was murdered last October, becoming Hartford's 20th murder victim of the year. Here's Reverend Saylor's brief but powerful speech.
I've come to this rally several years as a spectator, and unfortunately this year I have to be a participant. Because on October 20th, in this zip code, several yards down the road, my son lost his life at the age of 20, on the 20th day of October, becoming the 20th victim in Hartford, killed by a 20-year-old who just happened to have a gun in his car and wanted to settle his differences with a gun. Thank God it was just a revolver. The bullets tore through my son and ripped his insides apart. He never had a chance. What a nightmare. What a nightmare. For years, I've consulted other parents about their loss, never understanding exactly what to say. In fact, at the 19th victim vigil, I said, I want to get off of this parade of pain. I'm tired of this parade of pain, not knowing that the 20th victim was going to be my son, and I was going to have to lead that parade. It leaves a hole in you to the point where no one could understand or fathom. You're never able to go home again the same. Never able to look at life and your security the same again. I wanted someone to understand my pain and my grief. It seemed like the show went on and life went on for the rest of the world and you didn't understand what I was going through. Being a pastor of a church, at church that day, having a bake sale and a tax sale, raising money for the church, paying my tithes, honoring God, and yet this is what God delivered me, a dead son. I was at the hospital when he lied on the slab. I asked God to do a Lazarus experience. I begged him for an opportunity to glorify his name if he could just let this start this day all over again and raise my son from that slab. He didn't get up. It isn't a game. You can't press a restart button. Had to go on live. No one understood my issues until that fateful day in December when the innocence of our consciousness was attacked in Newtown. Since Newtown, you know, I got this expression, you know, I'm sick and tired of Newtown. I'm sick and tired of hearing about Newtown. Newtown this, Newtown that. I don't want to hear about Newtown. I want you to know about shame, the beauty of shame. That's what some of us feel rage. We were with Vice President Biden about a month and a half ago. And he understood our rage because we are appendage. We are a footnote in this discussion around the world. We matter. Violence did not happen in Newtown. It did not start in Newtown. It happened on the streets like Hartford and Bridgeport and New Haven. We had to sit there and cry until we could not cry no more. Asking, what's the sense of this all? Fear came to our children, and they had to deal with the stress of trying to circumnavigate the streets to school and back home again. And I realized something, sitting next to a father from Newtown in Danbury when Vice President Biden came. While I was sitting next to him, he was crying. He cried like I cried. His tears were wet like my tears. They were full of pain like my tears were full of pain. He had rage like I raged. If he could have his child back, he would have his child back now. You can have all Newtown. They didn't ask for this. And I'd be darned if I let anger or publicity, over publicity of Newtown, separate me from that father and his tears. I realize that I am Newtown. We are all Newtown. We need a Newtown where we can live safe and our children can go to school. We are Newtown. And we should let no one separate us. I got a message for the sons and daughters of Charleston, Essex that want to hold on to their guns and their magazines and their way of life and their violence. You need to hear the rumbling of a new town coming at you. We're not ever going to be silent again. We're never going to sleep again. Hear the word. Help me say the word. New town. New town. New town. New town.
That was the Reverend Samuel Saylor of Hartford, speaking at the 5th Annual March and Rally Against Urban Street Violence in Hartford, Connecticut on March 30th. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on the campaign for stricter gun safety laws in Connecticut and nationally by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.